Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Charles Morrison, president of the East-West Center, an organization based in Honolulu, Hawaii, which promotes better relations and understanding among the people and nations of the United States, Asia, and the Pacific through cooperative study, research, and dialogue. Established by the United States Congress in 1960, the center serves as a resource for information and analysis on critical issues of common concern. Dr. Morrison's appearance was sponsored by the Creighton University Asian World Center and was presented as the keynote address during the center's 8th annual Asian Culture Week. His topic will be Asia Megatrends and Implications for United States Asia Policy. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, October 9, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Robert Leager, Dean of the Creighton University College of Arts and Sciences.
Dr. Morrison has extensive involvement in the conceptualization, organization, and funding of policy-oriented educational research and dialogue projects in both Japan and the United States. He has long been involved in promoting the concept of Asia-Pacific community. In September of 2005, he was elected International Chair of the Pacific Economic Cooperation Council. He's a founding member of the U.S. Asia-Pacific Council, the U.S. National Committee for Pacific Economic Cooperation, and is a member of the U.S. Committee for Security Cooperation in Asia-Pacific. He is a past chair of the U.S. National Consortium of APEC Center Study Centers, a former director of the Center's Program on International Economics and Politics. Dr. Morrison, we welcome you.
Well, thank you very much, Dean Leager. And I also want to thank Dr. Jung. It's really a great privilege for me to be here in Omaha. My talk today is just about the huge trends and issues of Asia, very large Asia, including East Asia, Southeast Asia, and South Asia, an area of the world that has about 3.5 billion people, so more than all of the rest of the world combined. Very important area for the United States. And what I'm going to give you is kind of like the Platte River here, a mile wide and an inch deep. Not very profound, but hopefully to help you get a sense of what this region is like. Talk a little bit about U.S. policy, and I'll even say a word or two about what I think Asia means for Nebraska. So let me give a start, and if there's two themes to this talk, one theme is about connecting various dots, and the other theme will be about change. But many of you will remember the horrible tsunami that swept through the Indian Ocean, killed about 220,000 people in Indonesia and 10,000 people elsewhere. That was the day after Christmas in 2004. Maybe 8 months after that, there was a horrible earthquake in northern India, Pakistan, Kashmir area, about 70,000 people died in that particular event. And then in May 2008, there was another earthquake in Sichuan in China. Again, 70,000 or 80,000 people dead. These are just estimates. Those are all horrible earthquake events. But does anyone know how the dots were connected? What is happening here is that there is a tectonic plate. This is the India plate. It's moving northward into the Eurasian plate, and one end of it is Acha over on the eastern side. The northern end is where Kashmir is, and at the front of the plate is Chengdu, where Sichuan is, and right on the fault line is Kathmandu in Nepal. Now, Kathmandu is a quake that we can predict with almost 100% certainty. It will be a very major quake. Kathmandu did have a major earthquake in the mid-1930s, but then Kathmandu was a city of 50,000 people. Today it is a city of 2 million people. It has something like 1,700 schools, and I'm afraid to say that the school construction there is not very good, and so this is a disaster waiting to happen. The other theme is one of change. Now, they often say that there's only two things you can predict with 100% certainty in life, and one is death, and the other, of course, is taxes. And this relates a little bit to the aging process and death. And so there are some things in life that are quite predictable. And that's one of the things I want to talk about, is a little bit the things that are things that we can predict with almost close to 100% certainty, and then those things that are uncertain. And the areas of certainty are the continued rise, if you call it that, of Asia. Some call it the re-rise of Asia. The demographic changes in Asia, which I will talk about. The incredible pressures that both development and the large population base of the region put on the resource base, both in the region and in the world. And some new health challenges. The uncertainties are really how the capability of human beings to manage these issues, whether Asia can rise in a sustainable way, whether it can rise in a smooth or harmonious way, as the Chinese like to say, whether the international relations of the region can remain stable, whether Asia and Asia together with the United States can play the role that it will need to play as the a core of the world system in providing global leadership. So let's start with the re-rise of Asia in an economic sense. This is illustration of Asia's share of world gross product. And it has risen since 1970 from about 15% to today about 27%, maybe a little bit more. Most of that has been at the expense of the European share, which has gone down, whereas the U.S. share has been much more stable. But 200 years ago, Asia was as rich a place as Europe or certainly North America. It had 55% of the world's population, but it also had about 55% of the world's gross product. And with the Industrial Revolution, that share went down and down, first because the European share was rising, then because of the American share. And so the low point was really in 1950, when it was about down to 15% or so of the world's gross product. And it has continued to come up since. And probably by mid-century, Asia will be close again to at least half of the world's gross product. Now, that's not with 100% certainty, but that's with a considerable amount of certainty, because there are underlying forces that will make the share continue to go up. So what are the drivers of Asian growth? And one of the drivers is, of course, human resources. And how do we measure human resources? Often we measure human resources by how many people are getting higher education, because those people can do more efficiently skilled jobs. And the number of young adults who are going to college, as opposed to the total population of young adults, has risen dramatically in virtually every Asia-Pacific country. Now, the United States is here as a benchmark, and you can see in the United States today about 80% of the college-age population actually goes to college. In South Korea, that figure is now exceeded. In fact, the measurement is over 100%. You say, well, how can that be? Well, some people who are older than the college-age population are actually going to college, and so that's why, at least temporarily, it's over 100%. Japan is following Korea. Thailand is pretty strong, and it goes down the line. The weakest area is in southern India, but in all cases, the college-age population is rising dramatically, has doubled in just a couple of decade period, which is a remarkable development. And as you know, going to Creighton, once you're in college, the skills that you acquired are not something that go away again, but something you carry for the rest of your life. And so they help propel in a long-term sense the rise of Asia. And interestingly, this is not just young men who are going to college as it used to be, but young women too. In many Asian societies, the gender gap is largely disappeared for men and women going to college. In Thailand and the Philippines, there have traditionally been more women than men going to colleges. In countries like Japan and Hong Kong, it has been traditionally many more men, but that ratio is changing. Again, it's really in South Asia that there is some lag. But this is very good news for Asian economic development. It means that the human resource base is going to be across both genders. Now, another factor that has been propelling Asian growth is just integration of the region. You know that Europe is a area of the world that has been integrating very rapidly. European trade, about 60%, is with other European countries. But Asian trade is over 50% with other Asian countries. In fact, there's more trade among Asian countries with each other than there is among the NAFTA countries, Mexico, Canada, and United States, with each other. The reason for that is the rise of production networks in Asia. So a good, in order to be produced, may have parts that come from Taiwan, parts that come from mainland China, parts that come from Japan, and so forth and so on. So there's a lot of trade going around the region before the final product may be consumed locally, or still a vast majority of more sophisticated manufactured products go to North American or European markets. And this has been an important driver of economic development in the region. And other drivers include capital investments. The traditional drivers of economic development are land, labor, and capital. We've talked about labor. Land doesn't change so much. But when you see the accretion of capital, infrastructure in Asian countries, it's rising dramatically compared to any other region of the world. The expansion of the middle class is very important for future Asian growth. Middle class tends to be large consumers. In the initial development phase, export markets are very important, but that's not a sustainable basis for economic growth. And so you need domestic sources of growth, and that comes from the middle class. And finally, of course, affecting the whole world, including the United States, is the communications revolution, telecommunications. But in Asia, it occurs much more quickly than here because it starts from such a low base. This is catch-up economic development. And so a country like China, certainly a country like India, is still in a catch-up phase. Japan, 20, 30 years ago, was in a catch-up phase, and its economic development was very rapid at that time. But once it had caught up, development just went was at the frontier, and Japan couldn't go beyond that. So for China and much of the rest of developing Asia, they are in this catch-up phase, and the growth will continue to go up for many decades, but at a slower pace gradually. So let's turn to another part of the overview of what's going on in Asia. And this part is very interesting about demography. There's probably one thing that you learned very early about Asia. One of the first things you heard was that Asia has lots of people. And that is true. And China, of course, is still the most populous country in the world. And if you take a province of China and try to match it to a country, you can actually put a good deal of the world into China. here's southern China. That's equivalent of Germany. Here's Yunnan, the equivalent of Colombia. Now, there are some parts of China that are not very populous. So Inner Mongolia has the population of North Korea. The real North Korea is quite small compared to the Inner Mongolia surrogate of North Korea. Or Jamaica has a population of Tibet. But Tibet, of course, is much larger than Jamaica. You could do the same thing with India. India, in 20 years' time, will have more people than China. So India will surpass China as the most populous country in the world. But even though these countries are very populous, the population rates of growth are declining very dramatically, and in some cases have even reversed. Japan's case, the absolute number of people are now in decline in Japan. In the 1950s, the average woman in a country like China or Korea had 5 babies during her lifetime. The average woman today in Northeast Asia has 1.2, 1.3, 1.5, whatever. It's not even replacement level. And so you see what happens is that the birth rate has tapered off very rapidly, and then it becomes more stable. Southeast Asia, the same thing is happening. Again, South Asia is a little bit behind. But this is a trend, the decline in so-called fertility rates, which has happened previously in Western Europe, has happened in North America, but in those cases, happened over decades. In this case, it's happened in 20, 30 years, a much more telescoped period of time, and that has real major implications for all kinds of things. The aggregate amount of population in East Asia will continue to go up until about 2025, and then it will taper off and even start to decline. In Southeast Asia, the rate of increase is declining, although it will continue to go up for a while. It's only in South Asia that you'll have a continued strong growth in population over the next 50 years. And it's not just that that fertility is declining, that people are not having babies. The most remarkable development, I think, is that people are not getting married in the first place. And this is a illustration of the rates of marriage of women who are in their upper 30s. These are not women who are married and divorced, but women who never got married. And that figure is something like 15% in Japan. But in cities, it's much higher. So in Tokyo, 30% of women in this age category, 35 to 39, have never been married. In Bangkok, almost 30% of women in this age category have never been married. And those women who have never been married are not having children. And so we don't know exactly what the reason for this is. Many people have a lot of speculation about it and whether it's something that is temporary or will continue. But it is a important phenomenon in the region. Again, looking over the period of 30 or 40 years, these rates of being single have continued to steadily increase throughout the region. And the changes in fertility obviously affect the population composition. Now, most countries, and developing countries in particular, have a population that if you measure the number of people every 5 years, or you measure the 5-year increments of cohorts of people, you'll have something that looks like a pyramid. Not very many old people, but a lot of young people. What's happened in Japan is that that pyramid structure has changed, and now it looks like pretty much a skyscraper. Old people equal about the same number of young people. But if you look at projections of Japan in 2050, almost 40 years from now, there'll be many, many old people compared to the number of young people. This is a frontier in human history. No other society is this far advanced in the change of its demographics, but it obviously has very great implications for social security systems, for medical care systems, for politics in a country, for innovation in a country. It's something that we don't know about because it's never happened before in human history to have a society that looks like this. But where Japan is going is where Korea is going, where Taiwan is going about 15 years later, where mainland China is going about 20, 25 years later, and perhaps where Southeast Asia is going too. The United States, incidentally, is not nearly as extreme. Partly it's because we have immigration, a healthy amount of immigration in this society, and for some reason the birth rate, fertility rate in the United States is high compared to Asian countries or compared to Western European countries. Countries like Italy, Spain, Sweden also have fertility rates that are very low and below replacement levels. And while many countries try to have tax incentives, other benefit incentives to encourage people to have babies, they rarely have worked. Now, what this means is that the share of young adults will be decreasing in Asia. The share of young adults in the population actually has been increasing, and this has been one of the drivers of growth. It's called the youth bulge, but it will soon become a kind of youth bust, and the number of, say, workers in Japan in mid-century will be about 25% less than the number of workers in Japan now. Those in China will be about 10% less, and so the labor number simply will go down, and this will, of course, have an impact on the growth rate. And most importantly, the number of elderly in the society go up. Japan today, about 7% of its population consists of people who are older than age 75. So the standard age that we think of senior citizens is 65, but let's just use 75, 7% of the population. That's an old society today. But Japan in 2050 will have about 22 or 23% of its population that is over 75 years of age. And for other Asian societies, that figure is also will be increasing very rapidly. The other major trend, along with the fertility trend, is the growth of urbanization. Asia, say 20, 30 years ago, was one of the least urbanized of world areas, certainly compared to Europe or compared to North America or compared to Australia, which is the most urbanized area. Asia, most people lived in rural areas, but it's rapidly urbanizing now. About 1.5 billion of the Asian people now live in cities. That figure is expected to rise to about 3 billion of, say, 4.5 billion people by the year 2050. So the growth of urbanization is a major phenomenon, and you can see it just by the number of cities that are so-called megacities, over 10 million. If you look at East Asia and Southeast Asia, and I'm neglecting South Asia right now, in 1950 there was only one megacity, Tokyo, which today is still the largest city in the world, just in terms of the urban agglomeration. By 1975, there were four Asian cities over 10 million, and now there's something like at least 10. And I think it depends on what you count as a city, and I think the Chinese numbers are often understated here. There's a so-called floating population in China that is not reflected in many of these numbers. But you can just see that these cities are rapidly growing. And the same is true in South Asia. By mid-century, certainly, but much before that, I think Mumbai in India, Bombay, will be the world's largest city with about 40 million people in the Bombay area. And the reason people fled into cities is that it's very efficient way to organize an economy. They're very rich in terms of cultural activities. It's a very attractive lifestyle. And we forget that just a city can be an enormous part of a country's economy. The city of Tokyo has a greater gross product than the whole country of South Korea or of Australia or Canada, the city of Hong Kong or of Seoul, more than Vietnam. And Vietnam has 90 million people. So this gives you a sense of the enormous economic impact of these cities. But cities also have downsides. And one thing that we obviously know about is automobile crowding and traffic jams, but also particulate matter in the air. If you take the world's top 10 cities for polluted air, only Cairo in Egypt is outside the Asia-Pacific region. Virtually all the rest are either in India or in China. Jakarta also figures in this top 10 group. It's not a very nice group to be in, and Asian cities are definitely working on this to try to reduce it, but it's a downside of being in the city. And another is that as you collect people in a dense area, they are peculiarly vulnerable to disasters, whether natural disasters or man-made disasters. Aceh in Indonesia, where the tsunami in 2004 was most devastating, is an area where people have moved down from the mountains and into the city, into Banja Aceh, which is the main city. And so they didn't have the historical knowledge that the people along the coastside had about tsunamis, and they were very densely clustered compared to the past. And this is what you have. You have a region that is actually becoming more vulnerable to natural disasters, more building for disasters. About 80% of the people in any one year affected by disasters are Asians. Now I'm going to turn to some of the resource issues. And as used to be that you'd read a textbook and it'd say, Asia is resource rich. Well, resources are relative. And when you have a lot of people, and when those people use a lot of resources, you change from being resource rich to resource poor. China, 25 years ago, was an oil-exporting country. But China wasn't using that much oil for itself. Now China is very poor. It's one of the major oil-importing countries in the world. And so rather than being a resource-rich country, it's a resource-poor country. So the dot is its resource use, its population, but most importantly, its economic development. Asia-Pacific already is the largest oil importing region in the world, and that figure will increase so that Asia will, in fact, it'll increase much faster than these projections by the Congressional Research Service suggest, because the amount of natural gas being now extracted in North America will substantially affect the figures. But Asia will definitely be equivalent to Europe plus North America as a oil and gas importing region. And what's driving that is the growth of air conditioners, of automobiles. Developing Asia will have as many automobiles as the rest of the world combined in 20 or 30 years' time. And the amount of resources compared to the population and oil and gas is very small. Asia has a substantial amount of coal. Both China and India have a large share of coal. China has about 13% of the world's coal reserves, India about 10%. But China has only about 1.3% of the world's oil reserves. India has maybe 0.5% equivalent for a natural gas. So there's no way that the resources of these countries, domestic resources, are going to be compensating for the growth of demand. Another resource that's heavily under pressure is water. I think living here in Nebraska, you can appreciate that water is can be a scarce commodity. The parts of the world that are plentiful in water tend to be in the north. the parts of the world that have moderate supplies tend to be toward the south, and then there's kind of a belt of areas where there's very scarce water resources per person. This is per capita water resources, and much of it is in places that you'd expect, the Sahara Desert, the Gobi Desert, Saudi Arabia. Not much water, but not many people either. But then you have places like northern China, parts of India and Pakistan, where you also have not much water, but you have hundreds of millions, tens of millions, and even hundreds of millions of people. So the amount of water per person in these areas is extremely limited to begin with. And then you have industrial growth, you have changes in diets, you have other things that affect water use, and the scarcities become much larger. So northern China has about 65% of China's arable land. It has almost half the population. It provides almost half of the gross national product, but it only has a fifth of China's water reserves. So what do? The Chinese say, well, let's move water from central China up to northern China. They have a great scheme to do that, but it's very hard. It's hard for be hard anyway, because as it moves north, people tap it out along the way. But it's hard environmentally. And so there's a lot of rethinking about those schemes. This is an illustration of by a Chinese cartoonist of what the water situation is like in northern China. And it shows a well with a very little rope that grandfather had. And now grandson has a well, but it has lots and lots and lots of rope because the water table has dropped so much. And, of course, one of the drivers of that is a change in diets. The average Chinese, 1990, consumed about 40 pounds of meat on a yearly basis, and that figure has gone up about 250%. And to produce meat, it's much more water intensive than to produce the calorie equivalent of wheat or rice. Now I'm going to turn to a final area, and this is about health. And I'm not a health specialist, so I have don't take this too much to heart, but I try to divide it into three areas that make sense to me. There are traditional health diseases like cholera that peculiarly affect women and children, and as a result often of bad sanitation, ignorance about disease, and so forth. Throughout Asia, traditional health risks have gone down in terms of salience. And, in fact, a disease like cholera, almost non-existent in most of the region now. And then there are infectious diseases, including new infectious diseases and reemerging infectious diseases like tuberculosis. And these are diseases that in many respects have gone down, but are subject to outbreaks at any possible time. And in fact, this region is, as I'll explain in a moment, one of the fault lines, if you will, of health pandemic challenges. And the third area is chronic conditions and diseases, and these are largely associated with lifestyle changes. And they would include diseases like diabetes, like cardiovascular diseases, and mental health. Now, if we take infectious diseases, many of the infectious diseases that we know about have arisen in Asia. Not HIV/AIDS, but the Spanish flu in 1920. The largest pandemic ever known. Millions of people around the world were killed. Why is it called the Spanish flu? It's because a member of the royal Spanish family died. But it actually originated in Guangzhou, by all accounts, and so from China. The Asian flu also originated in southern China. Bird flu appeared in Hong Kong. SARS appeared in Hong Kong, came from southern China. Avian flu from northern Southeast Asia, Vietnam, and southern China. Swine flu, there's some dispute whether arose in Mexico or whether the infected pig originally came from China again. But just an awful lot of diseases have come from Asia. And there's some very good reasons for that. You have an awful lot of people in the region, and you have an exploding animal population. If you took 40 years ago, the population of China over that period of time has not quite doubled. The population of pigs in China over that time has gone up 500%. And the population of ducks has probably gone up 1,000%. As, again, people eating more meat. Here is, I don't think, a very accurate map, but it shows the poultry production in Asia. And as you can see, much of it is concentrated in China, in Vietnam, in Bangladesh. And these are areas where you really have to kind of track what's going on and whether chickens or ducks or geese are getting a virus. Because where you have a lot of animals and you have a lot of people densely packed together, the way a new virus generally comes to the human population is through the animal population. So the chances are much higher there than in many other parts of the world. But economic development is affecting this in another way, too. We have at the East-West Center a little research team that looks at Vietnam. And they are looking at the land use in Vietnam and at the disease vectors in Vietnam. And what they're finding is that in the cities, not so much change. In the countryside, not so much change. But in the so-called peri-urban areas, which are the areas around the cities where where there's lots of changes and the trees being cut and the farms converting into factories and so forth, that's where these disease vectors are originating. So this is something that we're still looking into, but it's both fascinating and also points to an area where we should be monitoring very carefully. The problem in anything like an infectious disease is you can, if it's in a country like rural Burma or parts of Vietnam, you can have a whole village wiped out, and the disease will already have spread so much that it's very hard to control it. Fortunately, we've been lucky with SARS. It was looked like it was one of a disease that could spread very quickly around the whole world, and in fact, it was contained with about 800 cases. Now, I mentioned lifestyle changes, and I love Japanese statistics. The Japanese in 1987 did a survey of how long it took 11-year-old girls and boys to run 50 meters and how far they could throw the softball. And 20 years later, they did the same survey, and both the boys and the girls couldn't run as fast as they did before, and they couldn't throw the softball as far. So what do you think is the reason for that? They've been playing video games. They have much less exercise than they used to have. And this is something that, again, we have lots of data on this is occurring, especially in city areas around the region. And this will show up later in cardiovascular diseases, in diabetes and so forth. Of course, one of the other things that kids are doing is eating a lot more sugar than they used to, and this affects diabetes rates. And so throughout Asia, but especially in South Asia, you have an explosion of diabetes cases. Now, another area is the mental health area. It's one I don't know how you measure, but the one measure that I thought might give some clues is suicide rates. I just assume that people in a modern, fast-changing economic situation with a decline in the extended family are going to suffer a lot more mental health. And if you look at suicide rates around the world, there are some places that traditionally had high suicides, like Finland and Hungary and Japan. But there's been a large growth in reported suicides in many developing Asian countries, including China, including Thailand, and especially including Korea. In case of Korea, the suicide rate was below that of the United States, substantially below that of Japan, but it's gone up tremendously, and with one spike at the time of the 1998 economic crisis in Korea, went down again, and then it started rising again. And now Korea has the highest reported suicide rate in the world. Now, this may be partly just statistics. It was in Asia, a lot of families would hide suicide in the past because it was considered socially unacceptable. The Japanese didn't, and that's why you see the higher rates in Japan. But I think there's something else that is going on, because even in a short period of time, you see this kind of rise, and it is so general in the region. But it may be different in different places. In Korea, middle-aged men, traditionally in Korea, the backbone of the family, nowadays often lose their jobs in their 50s, and so much more psychological pressure on them. In China, one problem is young women in the countryside. The men have gone off to cities to find other jobs. The women are left with the hard farm work and taking care of trying to keep the families together, take care of the old people, and there's lots of pesticide available. And so you see this as a form of suicide. But one way or another, I think the people are going through enormous changes in their in the life around them and having to adapt to that, and that's putting a lot of pressure on them. Now, I've used a lot of time, so I'm going to go kind of quickly to the uncertainties, and I'll just highlight various areas here, but they're all pretty clear from the presentation that I've made. Obviously, in an area that is as densely populated as Asia, which is using its resources, sustainable development becomes a big issue. And when it comes to carbon emissions, China is now actually by far the largest source of carbon dioxide emissions in the world. It passed the United States only about 3 or 4 years ago, but China is a developing country, and obviously as it develops its industry and it has still lower standards than more advanced countries, this amount of carbon dioxide will continue to go up. And this is true also of other developing countries in Asia. So Asia has become the largest source of carbon emissions, but the question is how people in the country perceive the problem. And if you're Chinese, you say, well, look, the average Chinese is providing only about a quarter of the average American's carbon emissions into the atmosphere. So the U.S., Canada, Australia, all large countries, lots of land area, people drive around a lot, very wasteful lifestyles by tradition, on a per capita basis, much greater emissions than an Asian country like Japan, which is one of the most efficient countries in the world at the income level that it is, and certainly China and India. So you ask people, well, who's creating the problem? And Americans say, well, China is creating the problem, because China is now the largest and is growing the most rapidly. And Chinese say, no, the United States is the problem. They have to deal with their issue before we deal with our issue. And the Japanese and Koreans are downwind from China, and so they say, well, clearly China is a problem. And the Indonesians are a little bit like China and where they're going, so they say that the United States is the problem, another developed country. And the Germans are far away from both of us, and so they say, well, it's about equal, both your houses. But the problem is when you have people with different perceptions about where the problem is arising, it's very hard to get them to agree on a common approach. Now, another area that's going to be a very significant issue, I think, for Asia is income inequality. Gini was an Italian economist who lived about 100 years ago. He developed a measure that is used by the World Bank and many other organizations to measure income inequality. And the lower the figure, the more equal the society. Europe and Japan have some of the lowest figures in the world. The Latin American countries have some of the highest figures for income inequality. The U.S. has a relatively high but somewhat stable figure. China, and these are Chinese statistics. It's come from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. The Chinese figure is rising very rapidly, and this is a rise that is not just coastal provinces versus interior provinces, although there's a lot of that, but even within the cities of China and so forth. And so this is a major concern for Chinese leaders because it's a question of social stability in the end. And it's in a society where if you get rich, it's not necessarily because you worked hard or you had the best idea, but maybe because of your connections and your political influence. Now, another area that is clearly an issue for the future, it is now, is governance. While Asian countries are often old, like China, Japan, Thailand, are centuries, not millennia old, many of the state systems, the political systems, are new. The oldest political systems in Asia are 50, 60 years old. Japan, the constitution from the post-war era. China, from the Maoist revolution 1950. Thailand, they've had something like 15 constitutions in the last 40 years. South Korea and Taiwan were both military dictatorships until only about 25 years ago. Indonesia was until only about 10 or 12 years ago. And so you see this is a very different situation than, say, the United States, where you've had a lot of evolution, but you've had the basic constitution and political system in place for 200 years. These are countries that are still kind of working out the role, issues like the role of religion, the role of the military, how the judiciary should be organized, whether it's a democratic system as we understand it or something a little bit different than that. A lot of evolution still going on and major issues to be settled in these countries. And then one thing you are aware of, I think, especially in recent weeks, is still the amount of international relations tensions in the region. Now, does anyone remember the last war between two Asian countries? The very last one. Okay, the reason you don't remember is because it's been over 30 years. The last war, which was a very minor one, was between Vietnam and China in 1978, so more than 30 years ago now. And you had those between India and Pakistan. But since then, it's been tensions. It's occasionally border incidents, like between Cambodia and Thailand. And so that's a good thing. But you also have rising ethno-nationalism, and that's what we're seeing in China, Northeast Asia, between China, Korea, and Japan over some of the territorial and maritime disputes. You have this question of the Korean Peninsula, and that's a relic of the end of World War II. It's not been resolved. You have cross-strait relations still, although they've improved very much. This region is one where regional organizations are still in their infancy. And the biggest question, I think, in the end is whether this region can provide some form of global leadership. I think that leadership has to inevitably come from the United States for decades to come. But the United States can't do it alone, and it needs, since the weight of the world economy is not transatlantic anymore but transpacific, the leadership has to come from transpacific. And that involves adjustments for us. It involves adjustments for Asia. For Americans, the adjustment has to be to take others into account in a real way and to understand what cooperative leadership is about. For Asians, it's really to think about not just national development, but to think about the global systems and how do you protect your own national interests the global systems. How are U.S. and Asia doing in terms of their relations? Well, generally pretty good. But Asian views of the United States tend to be more positive than American views of Asia. There is a tendency in this country, I think, to view Asia as a threat. Asians often have angst about the United States, but there's a lot of what we say in Hawaii, aloha, or positive feelings also toward the United States. If you look at attitudes over time, it's improved in many countries, India particularly, Japan, South Korea, but very poor still in Muslim countries like especially Pakistan, where we're involved in ongoing military operations. U.S. policy in Asia has not been one that has been very partisan. There's an awful lot of consensus across the different Republican and Democratic administrations in the United States, even though there's two basic approaches. One is to think of Asia largely as a threat. Is it a threat to our security as a big country like China is rising? Is it a threat to our economy as lots of manufactured goods or investment is coming from Asia? The other approach is to think about Asia as a partner in order and as a area of great opportunity. And then the challenge becomes, of course, always to be cognizant of the threats, but also to work with Asia in trying to develop a regional and global order. And that second one has been the dominant mainstream thinking, both in the Bush administration and in the Obama administration. In both administrations, there was an effort to strengthen our alliance system. The basic allies are Japan, Korea, Philippines, Thailand, Australia, to put more effort into regional organizations, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, ASEAN, which is Southeast Asian nations, to try to build cooperation with China while defending our interests, and developing a broad free trade agreement. This Trans-Pacific Partnership was a proposal of the Bush administration, ignored the first year by the Obama administration, and now picked up, and the Obama administration is trying to finish the negotiations. There have been some differences. The Obama administration has probably made more effort to show up to multilateral meetings. They tried an approach toward Burma, which actually has been not because of them necessarily, but it's been pretty successful in reaching out to Burma. North Korea, they tried to ignore more, whereas the Bush administration put a lot of effort into North Korea and got nothing for it. And then the Obama administration has tried something that initially they called the pivot and is now called rebalancing, and it basically means that this is the region of the world that's most important to the United States systemically over the next few decades. And so our resources that are devoted to foreign policy, defense policy, should really be focused on this region. And as our commitments to the Middle East go down, hopefully, we'll rebalance toward Asia, not toward Europe. The biggest problem for the United States is that we still are the largest country in the world in a superpower sense, and so there's a tendency, and this will be for any country that was in this position, for others to feel that we're arrogant, and certainly some of us are from time to time. The pivot has various elements. I think the military part has been received most of the attention. The economic part is very important, and the social cultural part is almost ignored in our rhetoric, but it has to be a big part of it. And that involves relationships of people with each other. And universities, I think, play a very important role in that. If you look at a state like Nebraska, you can see how important Asia already is. Nebraska has $1.3 billion in exports to Asia. Most of that actually is manufactured goods. You might think it's farm goods, but it's not. It's manufactured goods. This is an estimate of more than 4,000 jobs that depend on those manufactured goods. This is a figure that the Institute of International Education puts out. More than 2,000 students from Asia, about half of the international students in Nebraska come from Asian countries. And if you consider what they're paying in tuition, which can be pretty high at a university like Creighton, or consider what they're spending on in the community, they're enormous contribution to the community. And you have the sister city and sister state relationship. You have many other kinds of relationships, commercial relationships, cultural relationships that connect a state like Nebraska to the Asia-Pacific region. So each of you, I think, particularly you students, if you think about when you woke up in the morning, you wonder how much Asia affected you. Probably quite a bit, especially if you look at the appliances that you're using and so forth. So I think that it's really gratifying for me to come to Creighton and see the Asia World Center here, because I think this is just exactly the kind of thing that is needed, both to help educate Americans, because for Americans, Asia will continue to be the most important region and will become far more important to our future in 20 or 30 years, even than it is today. And I think giving the opportunities for young Asians to come to the United States, experience this culture, is very important. Unfortunately, it's still one way. There's a lot more Asians coming to the United States in higher education than are Americans going to Asia. So one of the efforts of the Obama administration has been to push something they call 100,000 Strong, is to try to bring American students over to China. Most of those will not be degree students, but just short-term students. But I think that will, no matter who wins the election, it will be a continued effort that Americans will try to do. Now, some of the implications of this, I think we still need a lot more work on Asian understanding in the United States than we giving it. As I mentioned, we need to try to broaden this out into the public realm more. Institutions like these regional institutions are essential, because otherwise you're inventing the wheel each time. And the most important element is leadership at all different kinds of levels, but especially leadership to deal with the big challenges of the region. And that's a big question for Asia, is whether given the enormous challenges they have, the much more rapid demographic change than the United States, the much greater pressure on resources of all kinds, the need to rebalance economies away from simply export-driven economies to ones that are more healthy in terms of a domestic content to growth, innovation systems. These are all enormous challenges, and the question is whether the leadership will be up to that.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Morrison for this wonderful presentation.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Charles Morrison, president of the East-West Center. Dr. Morrison's appearance was sponsored by the Creighton University Asian World Center and was presented as the keynote address during the Center's 8th Annual Asian Culture Week. His topic was Asia Megatrends and Implications for United States Asia Policy. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, October 9th, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, and to Maorong Jiang, Director of the Asian World Center, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.